Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Tony Leon, pleasure to see you here in the mayor's office.
Very nice to be here.
I'm sure you've been here once or twice before in your career. I know you've had some travails and experiences with former mayors of Cape Town, hired and fired a few of them.
Yes.
Have you been in this office before?
I think I have, yes, but it's a long time ago. I mean, before you came in, I think when Gerald Morkel was the mayor, who was installed actually after the previous mayor who I was responsible for firing, Peter Maree, which led to almost the disestablishment of the Democratic Alliance. So, yes, I have a long history, but this is a much happier occasion than some of the dramas I was involved in this very place.
An absolute pleasure to welcome you here. You've written about your travails with former mayors of Cape Town in a previous book, On the Contrary, which is an absolute must read for anyone interested in South Africa's recent political history. But today we're here to talk about your new book, Being There, which you've just brought out. It's launched this week. And before we get into the content, which is fascinating, of course, I want to talk a little bit about the method, because that always interests me. It is quite a thing. It's quite a thing to produce so much original content of your own thinking, so persuasive, so concise. How do you go about writing a book? Because this is your fifth, is it?
Sixth,
right.
And, you know, I guess each one you do in a different way. Mm. What happened with this book? I was asked by Jeremy Berain, who's the was then the publisher at large for Jonathan Ball, to write a book, what he said, political war stories. Well, I thought, you know, they're 1,000. So how do I make them into a sort of coherent and not too vast a tome? And so I set upon a series of themes. I thought, let me take the most interesting stories from each of those themes. And I started, the first was The Journey, which started with meeting Yasser Arafat in Ramallah and coincidentally my wife.
It was a fantastic story.
And then, you know, afterwards, Ariel Sharon and then Shimon Peres. And that then led me into a meditation on leadership, because so many grifters and populists are astride the world stage today. And I thought, you know, are there some consequential leaders and what are the characteristics of leadership? And that then led me to another digression, as it were, but on point, when just up the road here, I had lunch many years ago with Henry Kissinger. Mm. And well, that was a fascinating lunch. Unfortunately, I didn't keep notes, as I mentioned. But what he did was, when he was 99, a year before he died, he wrote a book called Leadership. And it really was I don't know if you've read it. It's a major work. And think, you know, how to be consequential at such a great age and have something to say. He had a lot of things to say. And one of them was that the world is unmoored because we lack the kind of, you know, the architects that he encountered who helped create the world order, from literally Adenauer in Germany to Charles de Gaulle in France, right through to Anwar Sadat in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And those were towering figures. And they have no replication today at all. Maybe Zelensky and Ukraine, you could argue, but very few. And there are a lot of reasons for that, which I look at as well. Anyway, I thought, well, having dealt with leaders or journeys, I then went on to the underbelly of politics, which is money. Mm. You know, you're a major politician. Fundraising. It nearly toppled the DA, one fundraising scandal I was involved in, actually happened. It also involved one of your predecessors, a man called Jürgen Hoxham, but I'd written about that before. So I didn't think there was much point in reprising that. But I did look at some of the personalities that I met while I was shaking the can, from Harry Oppenheimer to Maya Kahn and Tony Trayer and people like that, who really made a huge contribution to the business and economic landscape here. And then the inadvertent fundraiser for the DA, who's Ronnie Casrals, but I won't tell the story about him.
It's a great story. And I thought of it because he was back in the news yesterday saying more crazy things.
And literally as I'd finished, you know, writing that section, I thought, what's next? And then the phone rang, literally it rang, and it was John Steenhuisen, the DA leader, to ask me to form part of the negotiation team.
That's right.
For the GNU. And that then occupied a lot of my time last year, or 2 months of it, but it also contributed 4 chapters, because the difference between this negotiation and I call the section the negotiation, and previous ones like the Constitution or even the formation of this DA party in which I was intimately involved, is that this time I knew I was writing a book, and I thought, I'm going to keep a record.
Yeah.
Because I actually think, and you know, you can argue whether I had the right to do it, and some people say, but frank or oversharing, I actually think there's so much disinformation. Well, there is about everything. I thought, I'm going to just say it
exactly as it was. Happened. Yeah.
As it was happening, obviously, you know, from my perspective, and I was on, if I can put it this way, our side of the aisle, not the other side, but I had, we had plenty to do with the ANC and the world at large during the hectic 6-week process. And so I told the story in the negotiation.
Quite meticulously.
Mm. Well, I hope so. It literally is a day-by-day account because I didn't know how else to do it except because there's so much information. Obviously, edited it down, and I didn't tell every detail. Some are best left unsaid. But I think, you know, you get an idea of how it happened.
Yeah.
And I then spent 2 chapters interrogating what is going to happen. I phoned up John Steenhuisen about a month ago. I said, look, I hope this GNU holds, because if it doesn't, this book might be a bit superficial. He said, no, he thinks he described it then as critical but stable. Maybe it's a little more stable now and a little less critical, but who knows?
It's got to hold at least through the third print run.
One hopes. And then, I finished that section, and then I really wanted to deal with something which was very personal. And that was the death of my father, which is now 8 years ago. But also because, you know, the disinformation and misinformation.
And how that became another political war story, even though it shouldn't have been one.
Absolutely, and it should have been a time of, you know, family mourning, but it didn't. Mm. And then, of course, I got onto the story of Musi Maimane, because that was kind of contemporaneous, more or less at the same time, when he was, you know, offering me very warm private condolences, but keeping completely silent because my father had some controversies after he died. And then, of course, a year or two later, I was involved in a panel review. And this then led to his taking exception to what I called the experiment. And I then explain exactly why those words were used and the context they were used, which I think are entirely justified.
And those brilliant quotes from James Myburgh.
James Myburgh found the fact that the very people criticizing me for the use of words in respect of Musi, such as the Soweto newspaper, had themselves called Musi Maimane's leadership an experiment. Well, you know, that's how it goes. The next section of the book, The Reappraisal, was, you know, I do quote incautiously Woody Allen in the book, Jordan, who said most of your success in life is showing up. You know, if you've been around the block a few times and you're in a position of some profile, you meet a lot of people. Well, I showed up my first day in Parliament on the 2nd of February 1990 when F.W. de Klerk made this monumental speech, literally, I think, the most important speech ever delivered from the podium in Parliament was his speech on the 2nd of February. And 1990, and then so I thought, well, he's died since I last wrote about him, and I knew him pretty well towards the end of his life. And I thought, let's do a reappraisal. Exactly what did FW do? Was it all that was said about him? How much was true? How much was fake? Especially all the gay naysaying. And I thought, you know, he'd not always had a fair shake, and there was a lot to be controversial about, but you couldn't gainsay his achievement. And then also Nelson Mandela, obviously the biggest figure of the second half of the 20th century in this country. And I had a lot to do with him, in which I described those encounters. Mm. But since I wrote a whole book about him, I then, courtesy of, again, of James Myburgh, came across this extraordinary notes that Mandela had made in his own handwriting of his 1997 speech, one of the most important events in this country.
That's right, the Mafeking speech.
The Mafeking speech, which literally was the green light to CADA deployment, the National Democratic Revolution, and an unbridled attack on the political opposition.
And essentially, he was not just a messenger. These things were written in his own hand.
Well, that's the point. So previously, I had succumbed to the conventional wisdom. So, oh, well, you know, Mbeki or Joel Netshitenzi wrote the speech and Mandela was just the man deliver it, because that's what people were saying. And then I discovered, via James Marburg going to the archive of the Mandela Foundation that actually it was Mandela's own thoughts. And so I battled to reconcile this man who really conferred upon me a huge amount of FaceTime, lunches, breakfast, well,
offered
dinners.
You a position in his cabinet.
Exactly.
But you paint this picture of him, and I think increasingly this is widely held, that he kind of master of the gesture.
And the mask. The mask. And it's that brilliant book. It really is a brilliant book by Johnny Steinberg. I don't know if you've read it.
The one about his marriage.
Yes. Well, it's actually a story about South Africa. It's called Winnie and Nelson.
So I saw your recommendation of this book in your book and thought I had made a mistake by skipping over Steinberg's book, because I thought I wasn't particularly interested in his marriage with Winnie, and so I thought I'd just kind of skip it all over. But you recommend it highly.
Completely. I think it's one of the most important books ever written
really?
About contemporary South Africa, although it goes right back to the early 1950s. It's profound. But he makes the point that Mandela wore a series of masks. Mm. And I encountered several of those masks, both the warm, avuncular, really extraordinarily empathetic human being. And then the cold fury, which I was subject to on one occasion about one particular incident, which he couldn't reconcile with the rest of his famous and fabled persona. And I look at that in this book. And then, of course, the third character or third person who was not as important but pretty important was Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who I had a lot to do with, and we had a political collaboration, and he was a very interesting and indeed long-lived human being. So I looked at that, and then the next section of the book was really more personal. I call it personal pentimento, the nostos, you know, where we come from my boyhood, school.
Yes, I love that. I used to have a wonderful day out in Durban for 75 cents or something.
Yeah,
like
it was extraordinary. Well, I think you gave me the figure of, in your previous life, with a finance spokesman, so you know a lot about figures. It was unbelievable. I mean, the living in Durban was cheap, easy, fantastic, except for one thing. If you had a white skin, you enjoyed a lot of unasked and unearned privileges. If you were on the other side of the racial divide, it was pretty hellish. And, you know, because of my ma, we were exposed to quite a lot of that other Durban, which a lot of my schoolmates weren't, so we were politically conscientized at an early age. But I can't say that, you know, as I said, I mustn't over-egg it, because if you were living in Durban in the 1970s and you were white, it was a pretty nice life. But then I got the political kind of bug during that period as well. So that then led to other things.
And you became this... That's really the heart of the book. You've had this extraordinary career from those early days. You become this kind of young Turk upstart MP that upends the party establishment, such as there was a party establishment at the time, by unseating Helen Suzman's favored successor in Houghton. And then you go to Parliament. Your very first day in Parliament is this unbelievable historic speech that you describe. And then you have this amazing career as leader of the opposition, party leader, and through it all you meet these fascinating people and have these fascinating experiences and give us a little insight. And I think that's what makes the book so readable, is that you take us into these rooms and chambers of power, whether they be in Ramallah or some extravagant palatial landlord's home in Johannesburg, and much more besides. Of all of that, do you have in your mind a anecdote or a meeting with the most fascinating person in your whole career? And what was it?
Wow, well, there have been so many. But, you know, let me tell you a story that isn't in the book, because a lot of it is here. And, of course, you know, people just go and buy the book, hopefully, or borrow a copy. One of the more remarkable people I met, and he wasn't actually successful electorally, was the then Prime Minister of France. His name was Lionel Jospin. In fact, he had the misfortune, he was a socialist, of being eliminated from the first round of the presidential election, which led to Le Pen Senior, the first Le Pen, facing off against Jacques Chirac. So he wasn't electorally successful, but when I met him, he was here as Prime Minister of France. And, you know, he was intellectual and engaging in that very French way. And we were sitting at the Table Bay Hotel, just the two of us with an interpreter. And, you know, he was asking me for my views, and he, this was in about 2002, 2003, just before the 2004 election. And then he turned around to me in English, so clearly he understood and spoke English very well, but he chose to do it through interpreter. And he said, tell me, very French, he said, tell me, having listened to my spiel, he said, what are you in South Africa? Are you an opposition or are you an alternative?
Mm.
And, you know, there are a lot of one-liners, but that one-line remark stuck in my head because it made me think, well, you know, we can land up being the best opposition. We'd like to think we were. But are we ever going to be an alternative which can actually challenge for power outside of the Western Cape, which has a lot to do with the construction of the DA itself, was to try and create that alternative, not just a good opposition. And of course, you know, I mulled over that without being able to execute it. And ironically, of course, last year, if you fast forward, the DA did enter the chambers of national power. And I make the point in this book that John Steenhuisen, not the last, but the first in a long line of leaders of the liberal opposition to actually enter national power. Yeah. Now, that is, you know, you hold very significant power at the city level, but we never entered the national government.
Yeah.
So maybe if I was to go back on consequential conversations, maybe what Lionel Jospin asked me 20 years ago might start to actually become more of the reality, one hopes anyway.
Well, let's get on to the GNU. I think that's a perfect segue. I mean, the heart of the book is these incredible negotiations for the formation of the Government of National Unity, not the first Government of National Unity, a point that you make, but the first meaningful one, the first one in which the ANC actually relies on other parties for power, not that they seem to have clocked that yet. At what point in those negotiations did you think for the first time that there was actually a chance that these would work? You talk about this little wager that you had with Alan Windey. Alan, both you and I know him very well. He's usually the eternal optimist. I was quite surprised to read
30%.
Your book. He was the pessimist. He said there's no, essentially, very small chance of these things working. At what point did you think we actually could have a Government of National Unity here involving the DA?
Well, I, you know, it was a game of chicken in a way, because we, who was going to blink first or run first? I don't know. Sorry, bad analogy, but you get my point.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about cowards. I'm talking about you never quite knew. I think the first intimation I really got that it was going to happen was when we met the ANC on the Thursday, just the day before Parliament met, where you and I had lunch in
yeah.
the dining room. Thank you
yes.
very much for that. and David McCurry, who's really a first-rate negotiator, man of decency and consequence, I thought, he was sort of leading the ANC negotiations. And although we'd been dealing with him and Phoebe Potgieter and Parks Tau and Ronald Amola on occasion, Andries Nel, we were actually not, I described, they were just the tip of an invisible iceberg. And the iceberg was what we didn't see, which was this raucous ANC-NEC, where there was a lot of hostility against the DA or its participation in the government.
Yeah.
And the ANC had stood us up the day before. Helen very thoughtfully videoed the lunch that had been prepared by Dominique Boitens.
There was also a theme of the negotiations. They frequently didn't show
they
up.
Didn't, well, Helen kept noting that I kept a time. I decided to be a timekeeper and I had 28 minutes. This case was no show after 12 hours. I mean, this was on the 2 days before Parliament met. It was the 12th of June. And we were sitting in Johannesburg at the Endhoven home and they never arrived. And then Dominic Buerta Endhoven had prepared this beautiful lunch, and Helen videoed it and sent it to them. See what you're missing, she said. And, you know, they never said they weren't coming, but they never arrived. And I just thought this is rank rudeness. Or there's a huge problem inside that NEC. So now we all have to decamp back to Cape Town from Joburg because Parliament's meeting. And I then we had a meeting with the ANC. At just up the road here at the Sun Square Hotel in Gardens. And first of all, David Makura, who led the delegation, was very apologetic for the day before and said that, you know, we were tied up in very difficult meetings. And he then said, we sincerely regard this as very important. And we then got down to business. And so this is literally, you know, lastminute.com, because Parliament was meeting the next day to vote for the president or elect a president. And we'd made it clear without a signed agreement, without an agreement, there was a dispute between Helen and I whether it needed to be signed, there would be no votes for Ramaphosa by the DA. And we basically came to a broad understanding of what was required. We'd have the statement of intent. Well, then, of course, we then went through the night with copies. I think there were 10 plus copies of drafts and redrafts all flying through cyberspace. And, you know, kind of at about 2 o'clock on the Friday morning or later, Thursday night, if you like, I thought, well, basically we've agreed to it. And then the next morning, I thought, well, this is all done and dusted. I arrive at the convention center or at the hotel opposite.
Yes.
With John Steenhuisen and Leon Schreiber, Helen en route. And we get the latest version from Cyril Ramaphosa himself, from the presidency, which completely upended everything that had been agreed the night before. And I thought, there's no agreement. This is not going to happen. So, of course, you know, we noted, protested, sent back, and Helen addressed the media. And at the very last minute, they conceded.
It was actually about, if I remember correctly, 20 or 30 or 40 minutes into the sitting of Parliament.
Yes, and I do make the point, you know, thank heavens for Floyd Shibambu, because
calling that caucus, yes.
What on earth the EFF needed a caucus meeting for? But if they hadn't had the break, I'm not sure we would have had an agreement. We hadn't had an agreement, wouldn't vote Ramaphosa. So
yeah.
Actually, if you want anyone for the agreement and
Junior,
for
thank
Ramaphosa,
you,
thank Floyd Shibambu. But yeah, so that's what happened. And then I realized, well, then we had an agreement, and that's when we knew.
Mm.
But it was very last minute. And, you know, early on, I did make the point, and I had the advantage or the age of being the only one on our side, in fact, the only one on the other side, probably, apart from Ramaphosa himself, who'd actually been involved in the CODESA negotiations.
Yes.
And I've never forgotten that it was one night in November when the interim constitution was being agreed, and it was going to be agreed the next day. There were 5 or 6 outstanding clauses, and the ANC kept delaying. And I noted early on in my diary that this is going to be their tactic.
Yes.
They're going to try and railroad us by at the last minute.
Driving it all the way to the
driving
last
it all the way. And that's kind of what happened. Now, you never know with them whether it's cock-up or conspiracy, but on previous form, that probably was part of the grand design.
Fascinating. So the GNU is now, whatever it is, 9 months or nearly 10 months old. Moving towards surviving its first year. At times, that's looked unlikely. It's been on very thin ice at times in the last couple of months, particularly around the budget. But, of course, if you follow the polls, there's no party that would have, if there were an election today in the middle of May 2025, there would be no majority. There's no party with a majority. And so we would have another coalition negotiation. So you get the sense, as much as it has been driven close to destruction in these recent months, it is a model that South Africa is going to have to get used to. How do you currently see the A, performance, and B, kind of chance of survival of the GNU?
Well, those are two very important and broad questions. In and of itself, the GNU has not achieved very much. I mean, you can... let's just take the DA's bottom lines, or as we used to say in Afrikaans, still do, vertrek beginsels. There's got to be an increase in economic growth, and there's got to be a decline in unemployment. Those were really the two, if you like, cardinal reasons for participating in government. Well, we've actually seen no increase in economic growth, and, you know, we have a mountain of unemployment. So the DA's ability to influence economic policy so far has been modest at best. And the ANC's indication that's prepared to abandon the very policies which have driven South Africa into the ditch we find ourselves in also appears to be slight. That being said, you're quite right. I took part in a podcast the other day for a newspaper, and I guess, you know, a lot of middle-class folk were listening in, a lot of them all watching it, and they were asking me this very question. And I said, and I suspect that most of the participants were DA supporters. And I said to them, they said, what about the GNU? And then it was just after the first budget failure in March or February. And I said, well, let's poll the viewers. And it was quite interesting. So this was the result. 50% of the, they were given three options. First option, that the DA should stay in the GNU under better terms and conditions, 50%. DA should stay in the GNU under any circumstances, 49%. Hmm. DA should exit, 1%.
Extraordinary.
That was extraordinary. I'm not saying it, but and as you say, the polls actually are very strongly supportive of the DA's participation in the government. Hmm. Well, we can see why. Number one.
The alternative.
The alternative. And I do deal with that all the time. And in fact, when I wrote the aftermath chapter,
yes,
I was struck at a lunch I attended over Christmas at a big bank here, where everyone was saying, well, it didn't actually matter the GNU had done or not done anything. Just you're keeping out the others, and then they will destroy the economy. So the very reason...
Giving a new spin to just being there.
Just
be there.
Just be there. Exactly. So it sounds rather modest, but actually, you know, for a lot of people, that is, to quote the late John Forster, an alternative too ghastly to contemplate for many people. And for the economy, it would be just disastrous.
Mm.
So I think it almost is a blocking action, the DA's participation. Then, of course, within individual portfolios, and I'll highlight some of those, like Home Affairs, Public Works, the Deputy Minister of Finance, Agriculture, you're actually starting to see some results from someone other than an ANC minister being in the post. I remember, you know, let's just bring it down to your level. I mean, you took over as the mayor of Cape Town and you've done extraordinarily well because, you know, you have the gifts to do very well. And I think a lot of the DA, we don't have so many people in government, have those gifts, and they have that attitude and they have that work ethic. They have that honesty, and those should be unexceptional qualities. In South Africa, they're actually extraordinary. So I think that's been a factor. But, you know, it's early days. But to actually have to make a difference is going to be very hard. And
yes,
it's a curious coalition government, this, because on the one hand, the DA has kind of said, we hanging in under all costs. I think John made that point recently. The ANC equally, or the Ramaphosa faction, clearly wants the DA to stay. The other part of the ANC actually wants the DA to go as soon as possible. And meantime, the DA is in the government, but it's got a whole lot of actions out there which are not necessarily normal for coalition parties.
Yeah, well, let's just say what those are. I mean, it is a slightly bizarre animal where you are in the government, but simultaneously taking the government to court on a number of fronts that I think ordinarily and normally should be discussed at a cabinet level and resolved there, but aren't.
Yes.
I thought John Steenhuisen had an excellent a line on this when he said, part of the reason we have to do this, we challenge the government outside of the government and through the courts and so on, is because we aren't actually given the space to challenge them in the government where we are supposed to sit together around the cabinet table. So it is a bizarre animal. It really is.
Unique almost, I would say, but maybe that's South Africa.
So. But just one concern, if the word you use for track beginsel, if it is just being there, then aren't you concerned that it means that you have very little leverage?
I think the DA at the moment doesn't have great leverage in the cabinet, quite clearly, by their own admission. We can do a roll call. In fact, I examined some of those. Bella, which was a thick red line for the DA, that went through. The Expropriation Act, despite the minister responsible saying it's unconstitutional, that went through. And then you got to the budget. And what distinguishes the budget, obviously, is most huge. the finance spokesman. What distinguishes the budget from everything else that we've described, or I describe in this book, is that that required a vote in Parliament. So the DA's leverage actually isn't in the cabinet, it's in Parliament.
Mm.
And the moment something requires a parliamentary roll call, then the DA has much more power. If it just relies on the ANC in the cabinet, where the ANC is, you know, grossly over-allocated itself a number of seats, the DA's role is much slighter. So in a way, the contingency or the, did not say the contingency, or the DA's power is contingent on when it actually gets a say where the ANC doesn't have a majority, and that's in cap. That's in Parliament, not in cap.
No, that is a great point. All right, well, let's turn briefly back to some of the personalities you discuss, because I want to talk about Elon Musk and Donald Trump, I'm afraid. Not that that's explicitly covered in your book, but we are actually today. Trump is, yes. We're talking today on an extraordinary day for South Africa, actually, because today there are 50 South African refugees, a phrase that one would never have thought of ever saying, arriving in the United States. The first 50 under this bizarre kind of Donald Trump refugee program for persecuted South Africans. Now, South Africa has traditionally been a country that has received refugees by their many millions, from the destruction of Zimbabwe to you know, where else, the famines of Somalia and wars of DRC and so on. But we have never produced refugees, or certainly not under the democratic regime. So what do you make of this this extraordinary turn?
I think it is, as you say, a hugely important symbolic event for a lot of reasons. Now, I do deal with Trump and his kind of white nationalism, which is really what he does stand for, is a kind of reversion to nationalism, a destruction of the international order that I think you and I would agree with.
Absolutely.
Globalism, multilateral institutions, and he's pulled up the drawbridge on all those things, torn them up in many cases, and tariffs, of course. So why I think this is important is for the following. First of all, you can make the point, well, only 49, of 4 million Afrikaans South Africans, or more actually, 49 have gone, might be more to come. But I think it's exactly what you say. Trump and Musk, arguably, have zoned in on South Africa. And the obvious reason is because we've chosen to align ourselves with a host of bad actors in the world. And I interrogate some of those. Iran,
yeah.
Hezbollah, Hamas, the ICJ case. So, but it was very interesting to me, a business leader of South Africa who went to the Washington, D.C., a few weeks after Rasool was expelled, South Africa business delegation went, and he said to me, he said, you know what sticks in the craw of the Trump administration about South Africa more than anything else is DEI, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion. But in South Africa means BEE
and
employment equity. And bingo, we now have a whole raft of, quite frankly, mad employment
new
equity
targets,
regulations,
yeah,
which are just quotas, you know, which are going to exclude, you know, a lot of skilled people from the workforce simply on the basis of their accident of birth. So apart from being economically destructive, it is a complete rag to the Trump bull. Now, you can say, as Mr. Lamola and Dirk said, oh, we are a sovereign country, blah, blah, blah. Well, we are. But unfortunately, you know, when you rely on the kindness of strangers, such as we do, to buy our bonds because we're ever indebted, then it's very much a different ballgame. Even Trump, the big, huge America, learned about the bond market recently. That's forced a revision of their tariff.
And also he had to climb down on firing the Fed, the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
So the bond market, as we know, as my friend, who I also quote in this book, Neil Ferguson, the historian, says, is this Mr. Bond is much more powerful than James Bond, more lethal than James Bond. So what I'm saying is, just to answer your question, I mean, I don't know. I think it is a very fraught moment because, you know, Trump holds a lot of cards. A go is the obvious one. Well, the less obvious is, if we really get into trouble and, you know, we'll go to the IMF, America's got a veto power on the IMF. America's got a veto power on the World Bank. I mean, it's just that big. So, you know, you mess with America, it's got consequences. Now, you can't expect South Africa to simply say, well, you know, jammer dat ik leef, to use another thing. But I think a more sensible kind of adult pragmatic approach, yes, and based on country interest, not on some racial, national democratic revolution, would help.
Mm. I want to draw us to a close and bring us into land on how to actually deal with that as liberals, because that is the profound challenge around the world at the moment. You see kind of nativist politics, racial nationalist politics ascendant across the world. And here in South Africa is one of the rare examples where proper thoroughgoing liberals are also ascendant, now entering the portals of government, as you've written about. And how to do that? The pressure is immense. We've seen also Mr. Carney. Mr. Carney is also perhaps one other example
and
of a Albanese proper
in Australia.
Yes, a liberal, not in the sense that you would describe them in America as a kind of progressive or left wing, but someone genuinely committed to advancing political and economic liberty and common sense policies and so on. How do you deal with this extraordinary shift to populism and nativism around the world as a liberal?
Well, I think you need a form of popular liberalism, not populist, and that to make liberalism less of an abstract and more of a reality in the day-to-day of people's concerns. I mean, you know, Jordan, I've just come back from the UK and I happen to be there, not that you would have noticed, on the day when they had this earthquake local government elections, which suddenly saw Reform storm home in the north of England against Labour, in the south of England, you know, all over the place.
Demolishing both Labour and Conservatives.
Well, especially the Tories. For Labour, it's terrible. For the Tories, it's existential, as someone said. Mm. And now I see they're ahead by 10 points in the opinion polls. The vote were held now.
Reform.
Beating Labour and then the Tories coming third or fourth. It's extraordinary. So one of the reasons is that although Farage, you know, is a populist, he says the things that concern people. Mm. So, you know, I remember when I first got into politics, I had a meeting with a great sociologist, Laurie Schlemmer, who was really brilliant, and R.W. Johnson, whom you know well. And Laurie, I said to Laurie, you know, this was 1997, the DP was a tiny party. I said, we've got to deal with crime. It is the biggest single problem for middle-class South Africans. So Laurie, who's really a smart guy and was a pollster, said, you know, the DP's got no credibility on crime. Talk about the economy. I said, no. So I'm going against the experts. I said, Laurie, we're going to deal with crime. And, you know, we then set out policies. We then had a local government election, said more cops, less crime, a whole lot of things. Exactly what you are doing in the city of Cape Town with your metro cops, the sheriff, Mr. J.P. Smith. And frankly, Jordan, I'm not turning this into a mutual admiration society. You are an example of a popular liberal. You take the principles and policies and you make them resonate in ordinary people's lives, in their daily circumstances. That, to me, is what you need to do. Now, it did help Mr. Carney that he was up against Donald Trump.
Yes.
That's a very, if you're a neighbor of Canada, if you're a neighbor of America, and the big neighbors threatening your sovereignty, you're onto a winner.
Mm.
But you're right. I mean, I think that is the challenge. And I think, you know, Peter Bruce keeps criticizing the DA. You haven't got an economic policy. I'm sure we do have, but I think we need to make it more visible and apparent.
Mm. I read this excellent Janan Ganesh piece in the FT yesterday. What an extraordinary writer he is, a columnist that one must always read. And he made the point, and I think this is the perfect place to end, that really, the time has come for more muscular, sharp-elbowed liberalism. And I think if one can really admire something clear and bright about the career that you have had, the service that you have offered to South African liberalism and South African politics, is that you have been the standard bearer of really muscular liberalism that stands up against that nationalist politics, that National Democratic Revolution politics, and has set out your stall clearly for all. And for that, I say thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you and alongside and under you for so many years. And ladies and gentlemen, Being There is in all stores. There we go. Is in all stores. Tony, it's been fantastic to chat with you about
it.
Thank you so much. And every home should have one.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you very
really
much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.